Accession number 8950, roll number 1.
Mr. Ernest Hancock, Reel 1. Could you tell me something about your background prior to the war, please?
Well, I was born in London, in Lambeth, the borough of Lambeth, on the 29th of September, 1895. I went to a preparatory church school, then I went to a boarding school, owned by college, so-called college. There were 9 boys there. Then I went to St. Olive's Grammar School on Tower Bridge, where there were 400 boys. And from there, I went to the Grocers' Company Secondary School, north of London. I was always anxious to leave school. I was never very happy there. And at the age of 15, I left school and started an apprenticeship, a full apprenticeship, with the Vauxhall and West Hydraulic Company, Kempton Road, Luton, Bedfordshire. This was an offshoot from the original firm of Vauxhall Ironworks in London, and the products were marine steam engines, condensers, boilers, auxiliary pumps, and also hydraulics.
What made you decide to go into this sort of engineering? Had your family had a previous history of working in it?
Well, one of my brothers, who was, shall I say, always a great man in my eye, he was 10 years my senior, and he went through the similar apprenticeship, but he eventually finished at Vauxhall Motors, also in Luton, which was an offshoot also of the main company in London. Now, I served a full 5 years apprenticeship, with 4 years practical as a fitter and turner on marine and hydraulic work, and 14 months at Vauxhall Motors in the drawing office to finish off. And there I worked for the famous Lawrence Pomeroy, who was the designer of the Vauxhall racing cars and the famous 1398 Vauxhall. I also had a very good recommendation from him to the authorities in the Navy, and there's no question that my background was accepted as a trained engineer.
What was your reaction when the war broke out in 1914?
Well, the first reaction was, of course, to join up. But I was advised by Mr. Pomeroy to stay on and finish my drawing office experience. But I was associated with 2 other apprentices in the drawing office. One joined the army straight away, the other joined the Navy, and more and more as time went by I was anxious to do my bit, as I called it, and I had this recommendation to the Navy, and of course I wanted to use the training of a mechanical engineer in the best service I could, particularly being associated with car engines. I wanted to carry on with internal combustion engines, such as were being used in the Royal Naval Air Service.
You decided to join the Royal Naval Air Service. Well, what had you heard on, what did you know about the Royal Naval Air Service before you joined up?
Well, I have to admit I was a little bit snooty about it. I wanted to join the senior service. I wanted to, if you like, beat my pals to it. But I knew very little about it, except that they did have aero engines, internal combustion engines, and the type of mechanics which I was used to. And therefore, I chose it for that reason, but not knowing too much about it.
How did you actually join up? Where did you go to sign on?
I, first of all, I went to some place in London, a sort of clearing centre. I passed a verbal exam, very simple. How many sides to a cube? I got that right. And then I had a practical examination to produce a 3/4 inch cube in steel using micrometer. And this had to be within 0.001 inch, all faces measured and angles. This I passed, and I was immediately nominated as air mechanic first class. From there, we went to another place and were kitted out. And the funny part about it was I couldn't get half of my stuff in the kit bag, never mind putting the others on. Anyway, I managed to struggle into the various odd bulky clothes of the Navy, with an undervest which came down to my knees and all that sort of thing, stuffed as much as I could into the kit bag, and also was kitted out with a hammock, with two blankets and a mattress. This was all folded up in one great roll. And the next move was in a lorry, about 20 or 30 of us, to Chatham Barracks.
What was the date you joined up, approximately?
It was in November 1915.
Could you tell me about the sort of pattern and highlights of your basic training?
Well, apart from the passing exercise previously mentioned, when we arrived at Chatham Barracks, as much as we could do to carry our kit bag and surplus gear into a tent, a large tent, receiving recruits. And I wondered whether I'd done the right thing in joining. And I remember standing on the edge of the quarters, personnel quarters. I put my foot on the railing and looked across the barrack square and philosophized a little, and I was tapped on the shoulder by a petty officer who asked for my name and number. I knew my name, but I had a job to find my number, and eventually I gave it to him. And before I could ask him what it was all about, he was off. Except in passing, he said, "Fall out defaulters parade tomorrow morning." Well, I know I'm ignorant. I didn't quite know what a defaulter was. Anyway, on parade the next morning, after we'd done a lot of exercise, there was a bugle blown and I heard this order, default us to the right. I still didn't think I was in any way involved. I carried on with training, and one of these wretched marine sergeants came onto the barrack square. "Air mechanic Hancock," he shouted. I stepped forward and he took me down to the charge room. Jim of the Wand, as they call them, was the disciplinary officer, and I was charged with breaking bounds. I asked for an explanation, but of course nothing doing, and I had 10 days, 10A, which means 6 in the morning to 9 at night, most of the time in the galley, cleaning up, washing potatoes and so forth, peeling them and washing down. Well, after I'd done about 8 days of this, I had to sling my hammock, by the way, in the galley, in a large crowd in the mess, drinking, having quite friendly drinks and so forth. Another petty officer tapped me on the back and gabbled something which sounded like orderly, tomorrow. Anyway, we all had lunch the next day, sat down. I was making more noise than any, banging my spoon and fork on the table. And the duty officer came by. Everybody else had got their food, but we hadn't. And he said, "Who's the mess orderly here today?" I thought, "Oh my God, that's me." So I was taken up again. I knew where the defaulters parade was, and I had another 10 days, 10A. So there was 20 days of my first part of discipline training. We then had the Articles of War read out to us, that he shall suffer death or such other punishment as is here and after mentioned. One or two chaps fainted, but I thought this was going too far. Anyhow, the
how did you react to this discipline, and for your own experiences? Did you feel that the discipline was for a purpose, or did you feel they were being petty?
Training officer was a petty officer who taught us how to sling our hammocks and how to get our stuff into the kit bags. And I asked him why was I punished for the first offence. Well, he said, "This is an old naval rule." He said, "If you've got to assume," he said, "you're on a ship." Now, he said, "If you put your foot within 2 feet of the edge, never mind putting your foot on the edge of the ship, you're breaking a very serious rule." And I found that all the punishments which they meted out to me one way or the other had a very sound reason behind them. I hated the sergeants. They were really brutal with their ramrods, swishes, and the way they used to really labour us up slopes and down concrete slopes and so forth. But the naval officers, the petty officers particularly, were very, very helpful and understanding. There's one thing that Chatham taught me, and that was to read the rules and watch out. And I can say that I was never in punishment again because of that training I had on naval discipline.
You've told us how you reacted to the discipline. How did you react to the lack of privacy in service life?
Well, I have to take you back to my earlier training as an apprentice. And in the days I'm referring to, there could be nothing cruder than a factory. Filthy, dirty. You had to be as artful as a monkey. And particularly going to shipyards, as I used to do, as I was number one boy, I used to go with the foreman to the shipyards installing the engines, condensers, boilers and so forth. The filthiest lot of all were the platers. And that as a background, and the terrible treatment one had as a small boy stood me in good stead in answer to your question, because nothing could shock me, even at that early age. And I soon found that I could get on with people, and I made friends very, very quickly.
Could you tell me about your detailed training then in the Royal Naval Air Service?
Well, when we were drafted from Chatham Barracks with great relief, we went to the old Sunbeam Works at Acton, north of London. And there we had what was called training, and that was dismantling and reassembling completely out of date aero engines, such as the Gnome Larone and Mono Supap rotary engines, etc. This was so elementary that it was farcical, really. Now, when we were drafted to the Mullion Airship Station, I had training in regard to fixing of bombs, fusing of bombs, and fitting the bombs to the bomb carriers before the ship took off. And for a period I was in charge of the armoury at the Mullion Airship Station. And I had much to do there with the listening to the training and instructions on handling explosives. But there was no real trade training. I was accepted as a qualified mechanic, and class one at that, based on my 5 years apprenticeship. And most of my development in the air service was due to that background and the experience and ability which I had. I did have one course of training. I went to a factory to study the starting and stopping of air compressors. I think it was Ellis and Morecambe, I'm not too sure. And the reason for that was we had diesel engines for pumping the gas into the non-rigid coastal patrol airships.
You've mentioned your posting to Mullion. When exactly were you posted there?
Well, that was early, very early in 16. I was in a party of 24. We were the first Royal Naval Air Service units to go there, and Mullion Airship Station was just a field, and the erection of the main airship sheds and roads and so forth was in the course of being dealt with. And for the first month or two we were nothing but labourers. Some had training on air balloon. Anybody who was going to be a permanent member of a crew, four in a crew, had to have free ballooning training. But as an engineer, I was a ground man. Occasionally had a flight, but I was basically grounded for my work in the workshops. Now, I was dealing in the main with the overhaul, dismantling and overhaul of the engines, and the main engines were Sunbeams, V8 Sunbeam engines, and these, I will say later, these were quite unsatisfactory in airships. And when they were discarded, we finished with 100 horsepower green engine forward and a Renault V6 aft. You know what I mean by that, forward or rear. And also I handled the little ABC wireless set engines, which were actually used on the ship's flying.
You mentioned the unit. What was the name of the unit at Mullion, and what was the composition of it? By when you had to set up the actual station, but what was there at the station when it was set up?
It was nothing. It was a flat field. We had to build the first big shed with, of course, the experienced builders, because the shed was large enough to take two airships. And nothing much could be done until we had the first ships there.
How many ships were assigned to you?
Well, there were two coastal patrol ships.
And how many personnel when the station was operational?
When it was in full operation with two ships, there was about 500 in total. But thing I want to just describe, if I may, is the construction of the coastal patrol ships, because they had the decimal point in the wrong place when they were originally designed. Now, the whole thing was flexible. There was two gas ballonets, as they were called, inside the main cover, one at each end, and an air ballonet in the centre. When we went up in the morning, the centre ballonet with air in was completely compressed. In other words, the ship was full of gas. Now, if I can just describe a typical morning. We would have the ship in the shed, of course. The CP9 was the first one. It had the air chute behind the forward engine, and this was for blowing air in when the gas contracted, which it did when it got up off the ground and when the sun came out. So the ship was full of gas. It had two bombs, two Lewis guns, full of petrol, full of water. And this, by the holding party, the handling party, was, say, about 7 o'clock in the morning, humped out like carrying a great big fat pig out onto the air drone. And then the four passengers got in. There was the petty officer in the front seat who did the steering. The officer in charge came next. He had all the controls, both of the Malinois, putting air in, pulling gas out, and the control of the speed of the engines. The third from the front was the wireless operator. He had his little set, the ABC set, and he could wireless to the cruiser, the naval cruiser, which always came with us on our flights over the water. And the fourth position was held by the engineer, and he was in charge of the air bottles which started and started the engine. They also had spare sparking plugs and all the necessary kit. Right. Now these four chaps got in, and to hold the balloon down, apart from the party on the main fuselage, there were ropes on the front held by ratings, six or eight ratings on each, and the same aft. And the drill, the skipper would stand up and say, "Hands off, ease up the guys." That's the guy ropes. So of course the ground, the carriage force would let go, and the guy rope man would walk in, and the ship would sit there like an obstinate pig. The first thing, hang on, so everybody hang on again. And we'd shed two of the bombs, both of them in fact. Try it again, no good. And we'd shed the guns, the Lewis guns. Well, first of all, rounds of ammunition were shed, no good. Lewis guns, no good. Still sat there like a sour, an obstinate pig, great big thing hanging about. Then he'd start letting the water go, and you could just lift the carriage party could just lift the thing, and that was enough. As soon as it could be lifted a foot off the ground, he'd hang on again, and he'd signal to the engineer, he'd start the rear engine, opening a compressed air bottle, then he'd start the forward engine, the skipper would rev them up, and again the signal, and the skipper would raise his arm and then lower it. And the bugler, we always had to have a bugler to get off with, he blew the G on the bugle. That meant everybody let go, and the ropes were undone, they were run out, and the ground party on the chassis pushed this up into the air with the engines roaring away, and we would just manage to get over the trees and over the water. Now as soon as we started going up, and as soon as the weather got warmer, so the skipper, a grown man of 23 years of age, Struthers was his name, would start and had to start loosening the gas, letting the gas out, because he was getting over-pressurised. And this went on right up until about midday. We were cruising at about 1,000 feet up with the destroyer underneath. We there was no hope of dropping any bombs anywhere because we hadn't got any. But we did do spotting. We looked for, first of all, submarines, because they spotted us long before we spotted them. They were away, but we did help with debris. And I designed a type of bomb which carried a flare which could be more or less accurately